Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It was the winter of 1984. A young woman was sexually assaulted, and she picked a young black man out of a lineup. Nearly 11 years later, she realized she had gotten the wrong man. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. An account of the story can be found in the book entitled Picking Cotton, Our Memoir of Injustice and Redemption. It was written by Ronald Cotton, who spent those years in prison, and his accuser, Jennifer Thompson. They have since become good friends, and they are sitting in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Jennifer, I want to start with you, and if you could sort of briefly recount what occurred when you were assaulted, and particularly the presence of mind that you describe in terms of trying to remember all the things that were going on at the time.
Sure. I had gone to bed on July 28th, 1984, around 9 p.m., and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I felt and heard this noise in my bedroom, and something brushed my arm. And when I woke up and looked to the side of my bed, there was a person's head there. And I quickly said, "Who is that? Who's there?" And a man sprang up and jumped on me. And I screamed, and he put a knife to my throat and told me to shut up or he'd kill me. And there's a few things that go through your mind under trauma. I mean, the first thing is you're trying to make sense of it. Like, what's going on? Is this a robbery? Is this somebody who knew me? And then when you realize that it's not a robbery and I was going to be raped, the next thing that I thought about was I going to die? Was I going to be killed in this bed laying here after he raped me? And so my mind quickly went into this place where I made the conscious decision to not die in that bed. If there was a way to escape, I'd figure it out. But while I was figuring it out, I wanted to pay attention to what this person looked like because I believed that I was going to live. And that if I lived, I was going to hunt him down and he was going to spend the rest of his life in prison for what he had done to me. So I started paying attention in those brief moments when I could see him under different circumstances of light and trying to remember, you know, the shape of his nose or his eyes or looking for, you know, details about him like scars or tattoos. And you just start, you know, trying to remember every single thing. I was a fairly intelligent girl. I was a 4.0 student, so I had a good memory. I could memorize things and go to a test and make a straight A. So I was not under the influence of any drugs or alcohol, so my brain was fairly alert. And on some weird level, you know, when you are threatened with your life, you're going to die. My brain went on really hyper alert. And so that's what was going through my brain at the time, was live and then figure out who this person is and make sure he goes to prison forever.
Is in those moments, as you're concentrating on this and obviously taking in consideration everything else that's going around you because you're trying to anticipate things that you can't anticipate, as it were, what kind of state of mind is that like? I mean, what is it? I mean, I guess some might describe it as sort of an out-of-body experience for some
right.
people. What is that state like when you know this event is occurring and yet at the same time you're sort of separate as
mm-hmm.
an observer?
Mm-hmm. And I talk to a lot of women who have been victims of sexual violence, and one or two things happens. You either have an out-of-body experience where you leave the body because it's incredibly painful to stay present. But for me, I made the decision to stay present. I needed to be connected to my body. And so over the 25 minutes of his assault, I really made myself stay very attached to my body so I could pay attention. And it was a conscious decision for me. And I'm not sure why, except that I wanted to live so badly. I wanted to survive. And I was so angry for what he was doing to me. I was so filled with rage. I can remember thinking at that time, if I had a gun, if I could just reach over and grab a gun, I'd shoot you between the eyes and it wouldn't bother me. I could kill you. The rage was just so intense. And so for me, it allowed me to kind of be there in that place. And it was incredibly painful. It was incredibly frightening. But I think the desire to live was the most present emotion I was feeling.
Now, describe for us and our listeners and how you were able to get away from him, ultimately.
Well, at one point, he tried to kiss me, and I turned my head to the right, and that actually saved my life. He said to me, "Relax, baby, I won't hurt you." And for some reason that I can't explain, I said to him, "I have a phobia of knives." It just was the first thing that came to my head. "And if you'll get off of me and walk down the front steps and drop the knife on the car, I'll let you come in." And I don't know where it came from, but he actually bought that. And when he got off of me, I grabbed a blanket so that I could stand close to him to figure out his height, his weight, what his shoes looked like everything. I was trying to put together this puzzle. And he didn't go outside. He just pretended to drop the knife. And then he came back in and grabbed my arm, and I wasn't going to go back into that room. So I told him I had to go to the bathroom, if I could just have a minute. And I started thinking about a plan because I hadn't gotten that far. And then I remembered he had said he'd come through the back door. And so I thought, if I can just get to that door, that could be my escape route, which was the kitchen. So when I came out, I told him I just needed a drink of water first. And he told me to make him a drink. So I went into the kitchen. I turned the lights on because I knew the lights would give me about 15 feet, 5 seconds of a head start. And I began to make noise in my kitchen with ice cubes and water as I opened the door. And I just took off running through the neighborhood.
So what was your experience then like with the police when you finally encountered them? And what was the process in terms of identifying who you at least thought was your attacker?
Well, when I got to the hospital they told me they had this thing called a rape kit. They had to collect all this evidence. It would be there that I learned he had left my apartment, and in less than a mile and in under an hour, he had climbed through another woman's window and raped her. And so the anger and the rage was just unbelievable, unbelievable. And the officer asked me if I had gotten a good look, and I started to go through the description in my head. And it was so clear. The officers were like, "Do you think you could do a composite sketch?" And I said, "Yeah." And I wanted to. I wanted to get this guy off the streets. And so I worked with an artist, a police artist, doing what they use as an identikit at the time, with different facial features of what makes us, who we are. And I began to put together this composite of what my memory recalled. And it was a darn good composite, which ran in the newspaper, which ran in, it led to suspects. But the most glaring suspect was a woman who had called in and said it looked like a guy named Ronald Cotton, who she said she had seen on a bicycle at my apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning wearing the exact clothes I had described my attacker wearing at the same time on the same day at my apartment complex. And it just kind of fit. Although they didn't tell me that at the time. And that led to a photo lineup. I picked out Ronald Cotton's photograph. That led to, about a week later, a physical lineup, where once again I picked out Ronald Cotton out of the physical lineup. And honestly, once he was picked out of a physical lineup, he was done. He was going to trial.
Now I want to turn to you, Ronald. Tell me first about your encounter, how you first became aware the authorities were looking for you. What was your reaction? What transpired there?
Well, I just arrived home that morning, August the 1st, and my mother's boyfriend was standing outside, early in the morning. And as I approached the place, he told me that the police had been looking for me for a rape in the community. And I immediately told him that, I didn't commit such a crime as that. And he said, "Well, they've been here. They took a pair of your shoes, my shoes, and your sister's shoes." And so he said that you ought to go down and find out what's going on. But I couldn't drive my car because my transmission was out. So the only thing I was riding at the time for transportation was a 10-speed bicycle. And I wasn't going to ride that down there. So I saw my neighbor outside sweeping the front porch. And I walked over and asked her, could I borrow her car to go down to the police department, find out what was going on, because I was now being wanted for a crime that I had not committed. And so she said, "Well, you can go ahead and just make sure you have my car back by 3 o'clock because I have to go to work." So I went over and to the house and asked my sister, Tootie, to ride down with me just in case they took me into custody. That way, the lady could get her car back. And so I asked my sister to go ahead and drive this car while I read this paper that they left at the house. And as I was going down the road, I, start reading. And once we arrived at the police department, you know, in the parking lot, I looked up at the building as I was getting out the car and walking toward it. The police was upstairs looking out the window. They started running away from the window to, you know, meet me. And once I got to the door, an officer stepped out and identified himself as Detective Golden. And I identified myself to him, told him why I was there, and he said, come on in, let's talk about it. They took me upstairs and started interrogating me about my whereabouts of the night this crime was committed. And once I told them my story, not one time but two times, I realized, you know, that I got my weekends confused. So therefore, they had in their head that I was lying, and they took me into custody.
Now, you obviously were in a lineup. What was that like? Well, were you still confident that you would be able to, that you would not be identified as the assailant? Or
yes, I did think that. But, you know, once we went through the procedures of the lineup, you know, I was thoroughly checking out, you know, the guys that were in the lineup, which most of them worked for the city, some of them were police officers themselves. And I was the only one that was not. You know, my lawyer was present, and Jennifer was instructed to choose the one that she thought the most looked like her assailant. And so we went down the line 1 through 7. When it got to me, I was number 5. I was instructed to step out and say, hey, baby, how you doing? Take a 360-degree turn and step back. And once I completed it, you know, she settled upon my number. She wrote the number down and showed it to the detective. The detective took it over and showed it to my attorney. Once my attorney, I noticed, lowered his head down. I knew that I had been picked.
Now, you were in the same room, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, so you could see each other?
Yeah.
This was in an old schoolhouse, so the police department was being renovated, so they took us upstairs in this room that was just a classroom with a table me and these 7 men in the lineup, and it was, for both of us, it was absolutely terrifying, just terrifying, because I believed him to be, obviously, this, you know, violent man, and if I didn't find him, he was going to walk and then kill me. And then, of course, I'm sure for Ron, it was equally as terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, Ron, what was that like? I mean, because most of us, you know, we watch television, right? So right. People can't see each other. But there you were looking at what obviously was the potential accuser. I mean, that's a very personal moment, I guess.
Well, it was terrifying for me, you know, due to the fact of being put in that position for something you did not do. And, you know, I was very nervous. And, you know, it seemed like my legs were wobbly, you know. But once I was chosen, I just dropped my head and said to myself, you know, no. I said, this can't be real. But they put me back in the county car and took me back to the county jail.
Now, from the book, I understand that you also felt that there was a certain racial component to all of this. Tell me about that.
Well, I was involved in a racial relationship. I had been for some time. And I just felt like, you know, the questions that was asked, you know, me that particular day, that, you know, it was done intentionally, you know, to really go ahead and put these said charges on myself. Because this one officer, you know, he stated to me that I thought I was Mr. Big Stuff because I was dating white girls, you know, and stuff like that. I, you know, it stuck in my head and still is there today, you know, because, you know, he make such a statement as to that, you know, and calling me niggers and things like that, you know. But I didn't let that break me down because, you know, I knew I hadn't committed such a crime. I told them I know why they're doing what they're doing. And so they instructed me to go back in the back with this officer and to be fingerprinted and photographed and put in custody.
Yeah, this is, and it reminds people that this is, even though this is in the Carolinas, this is the mid 1980s. I mean, this is long
it's not
past.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, this is the kind of atmosphere that you think that this was an atmosphere within the police department, or do you think you were dealing with somebody, a couple of individuals who had this kind of attitude?
Just a couple of individuals.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a whole police department. So, you know, I had to swallow my pride and, you know, go with the flow.
Now, and for Jennifer, for you, I mean, you became very attached to some of the officers and some of the authorities, and obviously what was your perception of the police in terms of how they were carrying it out? I mean, did it seem very straightforward? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I had never been involved in any type of police, you know, work or been around a police department, so they treated me with a great deal of respect, and you know, they wanted to help me make sure that we got the right person, that we got the guy off the street, and I really didn't think anything about it. On all sincerity, I thought that everything was being done the correct way, and for 1984, it was being done as far as the lineups. I mean, that was protocol. That's the way they did it. I didn't know until many, many years later what was happening under the surface with this one police officer and Ronald, and it would be years after he and I became friends that he would tell me what he just told you, and I was just shocked. I couldn't believe it that, in like you said, in the mid 80s, there could be, you know, that kind of mindset still in our culture. But looking back on it now, and the work that we do, I can say it's not an uncommon practice.
Now, Ronald, obviously, you were convicted, and you had this experience of almost 11 years, I guess it was, in prison. Describe for people what that was like, particularly being in prison for a crime that you didn't ultimately commit.
Well, it was miserable, but, you know, I managed to deal with it one day at a time. You know, I was often write my family, you know, expressing my feelings. And also I did a lot of research in my case because I was in a world, you know, world in another world. And I knew only I could survive myself. You know, I didn't want to break down, you know, attempt to escape, you know, run away from justice. You know, I wanted to go to war and fight fire. And I did just that, you know. I ended up meeting actual perpetrator of the crime, you know, 94 days after I was incarcerated. I just really felt like tearing him apart, but my father, you know, who came to visit me, told me not to do that, that eventually, you know, he'll come forward, you know, but it took so long, you know. I walked around and noticed how often, you know, I was observed by this guy at a distance. You know, you feel like someone's watching you. You take a look around trying to figure out where and who it is. And once I did, you know, he would walk away.
But yeah, because this was Bobby Poole who ultimately committed these crimes. What was your encounter like with him? How did you assess who he was? Because you probably had the closest of the two of you, the closest relationship or at least sense about who this guy was. What kind of feeling did you get about him?
Well, I first saw him when I was in the streets. I was dating a young lady, and we was at a house watching a movie, her and I, her mother, and there was a knock at the door, and her mother instructed her to go and see who was there. And once she did, you know, she stayed away too long, I thought, so I went to investigate. And once there at the door, I noticed she was communicating with this guy, and I told her, well, do you want to see me or you want to see him? Let me know. You know, I can just leave. And so she, you know, sent him away. And after that, you know, that's when I met him in prison. I was walking down this tunnel, and he was being escorted by a correction officer. And I happened to look over and notice this guy. And it immediately came back to me that I saw him before, and that was at that my ex-girlfriend's door. And a day later, I was outside in the prison yard playing handball and observed him standing on the sideline, you know, observing the game. And I immediately had someone come to relieve me from the game, and I approached him and asked him where was he from. He told me that he was from the same hometown I was from, and I asked him about whether he committed this crime upon Jennifer, and he immediately told me no, but I kept a drawing of the composite sketch. I cut it out the newspaper. I had it in my possession in my locker, so immediately I went up to my dorm and retrieved it from my locker, and I compared it, and I said, that's him.
And you actually, I think, ultimately wound up getting a picture of the two of you, I think it was, together, to send to your lawyer.
Yes, he wanted to write one of my sisters. I have eight sisters, and he asked me about a certain one, and I said, well, I tell you what, if you want to write my sister, I said, we'll take a picture together, and I write a letter, send it to her, and let her observe it. If she likes what she sees, she'll write you. I said, if she don't, I leave that up to her. So immediately, once I received the picture, I wrote a letter to my attorney and sent it to him. And, you know, a couple of weeks went by. He come back to me, so, well, have you heard from your sister? I said, no. I said, evidently, she didn't like what she see or saw. So that's the way it is, you know.
Now, you ultimately, I think, you got a second trial, but you faced not only, obviously, the testimony from Jennifer, but also the second woman who had not come forward before. And it seemed as if you were at this, at one moment, there was this idea that you could get a second trial, that perhaps something, things would go different. And then all of a sudden, your hopes seemed to be dashed in a moment. What was that like? What your sense was about that?
I just couldn't believe it. You know, it felt like I was in a dream. It went bad, you know, because Mr. Poole, he came back to trial. You know, I go back to trial for the new trial, and all these new charges come up. I just shook my head. I couldn't believe it. I think maybe it was put up to her to come forward and state that she knew it was me, and, you know, that she was afraid that I was going to get a little loose or get cut free and kill her or something like that. So, you know, to close the book on the case, you know, they just put these said charges upon myself.
Now, Poole was, I guess, in the courtroom, is that right? You and Jennifer, you saw him?
Yes.
Did you realize, I mean, obviously you didn't realize what the connection, but do you remember seeing him in the courthouse?
Oh, I remember seeing him in the courthouse, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was under voir dire, so they would remove the jury. And, of course, the judge asked if he had, you know, confessed if he had done the crime, and he, of course, denied it. And by that point, it's been 3 years. And they asked me, did I recognize Bobby Poole? Was he the man who raped me? And I said, no, sir. It was Ronald Cotton. And that's all they needed to hear.
And it even though you were confronted with the actual target, your memory just would not move away.
You know, that's the way memory works. That's something that human beings don't really understand about memory. By that point, it had been 3 years. And so everything had been contaminated. That's what I usually tell people. That's how I try to explain it. So, you know, I had gotten a good picture of him in my mind that night of the rape of Bobby Poole. But Bobby Poole was never in the lineups. So your mind automatically does something called relative judgment.
Describe that to us.
Well, we do it all the time when we take SAT test or ACT test. You got five choices, little bubbles in front of you. You can quickly discount three of them. It narrows it down to two. And you pick the best one. And you don't know you're doing any of it. But because Bobby Poole was not in what they call a six-pack, the six photographs, what your brain does is say, well, then which one looks the most like my memory? Now, my memory at this point had become a composite sketch. So when I had the actual memory of Bobby Poole, the composite sketch overlaps my true memory, and it does something called enmeshment. It just blends the two pictures together. So when I'm looking at the photographs, I'm choosing the person who looks more closely to the composite sketch, not to my memory. By the time I pick Ronald out of a photo lineup and I go to the physical lineup, he was the only person that was in both. So your brain automatically says, oh, my God, that's the guy. I'll never forget that face. Because I just picked him out of a photograph a week before. By the time he's picked out and I'm given, you know, the what I call a tens from officers, great job, that's who we thought it was, that's who our suspect was, that's who you picked out of the photograph, it cements the image in my brain forever, forever. So Ronald Cotton's face now is in my nightmares. and it transplants. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So when I see Bobby Poole 3 years later, my brain has no recognition of that. It has this contaminated version of the truth. And you can't uncontaminate it ever.
Even though he was like inches away from you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's fascinating how our memories work. And it's scary because 75% of our wrongful convictions hinge on a single eyewitness ID.
Ron, ultimately, you were exonerated with a DNA test. Describe a little bit about that. I understand it was sort of one of the first ones to actually move through the courts to get someone freed. But what was that like? How did that happen?
Well, I was in Mason, Tennessee, and I was watching the O.J. trial going on. They were describing this blood, how DNA worked, and so I became interested, and I put my little legal pad up my locker and my pen and started taking notes. You know, I retrieved my radio out my locker, hook it up with my headphones, and just wanted to listen and see what was going on about this DNA. And finally, you know, I decided, you know, that I was going to write the Court of Appeals to request it to be done in my case. And so I sat down, I wrote the letter, I sent it to the Court of Appeals. A couple of weeks went by, and they responded and said that they're going to grant me, you know, a DNA, that what did I want to do, take it or not? Said, but if the results from the test came back stating that I had committed such a crime, but this is where I was going to spend the rest of my life in prison. And so I wrote them back, and I told them, well, put the foot down that I did not have anything to lose because I'm an innocent man. I said, if the test come back saying anything different, that's because someone tampered with it.
And ultimately, of course, you were exonerated. And ultimately, you began, Jennifer, you realized, you were informed, I guess, that this indeed was not the person who had assaulted you. I think you write, after you were told that, you said, I couldn't speak. I knew I had to keep it together in front of them, being the officers, although it felt like everything I'd staked my life on, how I made sense of what happened to me, suddenly fell through a trap. Silently, I berated myself. It meant I had screwed up. They had brought Bobby Poole into the courtroom during the second trial. How could I have been in the same room as my rapist and not recoil? What was that moment like when you finally realized that all this investment, emotional investment, and you were wrong?
Well, on some level, it was probably harder than the actual rape, because I knew how to be a victim. I'd been a victim for 11 years. I mean, I knew how to do it, and it sounds very strange, but when I realized the mistake that had been made, the tables had turned for the first time. And Ronald now had become the victim, and I had become the offender. And so it was like being swallowed in this giant black hole, and I couldn't breathe, I couldn't focus. And I was terrified. I was fearful. I thought, here comes this man out of prison, he's going to kill me. Mm-hmm. 11 years of his life is gone. He's got to hate me. He's going to track me down, and he'll kill me.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Ron, you told her when you met her that you forgave her in just 15 seconds or so. What was that like? And did you come to that decision already by the time?
I had. It was in 87. I was sitting on my bunk in Central Prison writing a letter to a pen pal, and a vision came over me of a female with no face. So I stopped writing and actually, Lord, what was he trying to show unto me? And the only female I could think about was Jennifer. She came to my mind. Asked him to give me the strength, to have the faith to, you know, take this, the way that I was feeling toward her, away, that, you know, I never hated her, and I wanted to do it right, you know, to make my life easy and living in prison. And after that prayer, you know, I felt much better. I was able to deal with my time on a more easier level, you know, and I was just going through the process of living my life in prison, knowing that's where we're going to be until.
We've been speaking with Ronald Cotton, who spent nearly 11 years in prison, also Jennifer Thompson, who had mistakenly accused him of being the one who carried out sexual assault against her. That was in 1984. He was exonerated, and both have actually become friends. since then. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.